Harris. And if anyone has cell phones or electronic devices, if we could please mute them or turn down the volume, that would be great. The mission statement of the Veterinary Board is here to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the general public, as well as the welfare of animals, by enforcing the licensing standards prescribed by statute for the licensing and regulation of veterinarians, veterinary technicians, veterinary premises, and animal crematories. All right, Dr. Byrne, would you like to do the roll call?
Dr. Byrne, present. Dr. Jane?
Present.
Dr. Nosley?
Here.
Ms. Solomon?
Present.
Dr. Thompson?
Here.
Dr. Wright?
I think only for three.
Just okay. For some of them. And Dr. Wright, can I please speak into your microphone? Because they're not picking it up.
Okay. Let me start over. Dr. Wright is absent, available by phone later for some cases. And Dr. Thompson?
Here.
Ms. Solomon?
Here.
Dr. Nosley?
Here.
Dr. Jane?
Here.
Ms. Ross is absent, and Dr. Byrne is present.
Great. We have quorum. All right, so for the initial investigative reviews, we're going to start with number 8. We will then go to number 10. We will then go back to the top and do 1. Then we'll do 3. Then 4. Then 9. Then 2. And then 3, 5, 5, 6, and 7. Okay, so we'll go ahead and get started. Looks like the first one we're going to do is case 2510, and Dr. Nosley, you are the lead.
Would you like me to read the front load?
Please.
On case 2510, and the complainant is Ross and Kimberly Valente, the respondent is Nicholas Meredith DVM. On June 16, 2024, Rocky, a 2-year-old male pug, was presented to respond for vomiting and straining to urinate that had started the previous day. Radiographs revealed a distended bladder and a stone at the end of the os penis. Respondent attempted to relieve the pressure in the bladder via a decompressive cystocentesis. Despite the dog's being sedated, he moved during the procedure. Respondent determined the dog's bladder ruptured. Respondent advised the pet owners that the dog's bladder rupture, which is a complication of urethral obstruction when a bladder is not distended for a prolonged period of time. Surgical options were discussed with complainants along with costs. Complainants elected to humanely euthanize the dog. And the committee concluded that possible violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred. It was moved and seconded that the board find ARS 3222-32-11, gross negligence, failure to definitively diagnose the dog with a ruptured bladder, which led to the demise of the dog.
J. Valenti.
Great. And Dr. Nosley is the lead, so he will go ahead and start with questioning. You have 5 minutes and you have a prepared statement that you want to read. You can go ahead and read that now. We have all the materials that have been provided already, so you don't have to go through everything that you've already submitted to us. It would just be anything additional or anything you want to drop.
Anything additional? We lost a family member, for routine, UTI, which we thought, you guys have been raised here to us in the treatment of our family, and we, one of the previous vet boards said that he's never seen this in 40 years, so we're hoping to get him some justice, our dog. He did deserve this, and we're just looking to move forward from today. And that's pretty much it. We stated all the evidence before. And just a tough issue for my family and I. That's pretty much all I have to say.
We're very sorry for your loss.
Yeah, thank you.
Anything else? We do not have a response.
Right. Okay.
Sorry, I don't see that on the list. Is that correct?
Yeah, just Mr. Stoll. Mr. Stoll is here and has a statement.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Mr. Valenciano, have you stepped out? Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the board, Dr. Meredith could not be here today because she is on her honeymoon, actually. But in advance of today's review hearing, we submitted her personal statement dated November 29th, and that sets forth in detail our position with regard to the proposed violation in this case. As this board well knows, urinary tract obstruction cases are problematic, especially in cases like this where an obstruction is allowed to persist for a significant period of time, and there are inherent risks of a bladder rupture in these cases. When Rocky's obstruction in this case could not be alleviated using non-surgical methods and there were complications, the owners were given the option of pursuing a surgery, but they declined and elected humane euthanasia. So we do have an unfortunate outcome in this case, but as set forth in Dr. Meredith's statement, it was not a result of her violation of any statute or regulation. As set forth in her statement, Dr. Meredith is an experienced emergency veterinarian with over 10 years of experience, and she has performed literally thousands of cynthiocentesis procedures in compliance with the applicable standard of care, and that applies in this case as well. For the reasons set forth in Dr. Meredith's statement, we strongly feel that this complaint should be dismissed. Thanks.
So, in this case, the investigative committee felt that there was reason to maybe, or they felt fairly strongly that perhaps this dog's bladder did not rupture. And I have a different interpretation of this case from the investigative committee. They expressed concerns saying the bladders don't rupture with cystocentesis. It may have just been some leakage. Cystocentesis is unlikely the cause of bladder rupture because it's so commonly done. And I disagree with those statements. This was not a routine cystocentesis by any means. This was a bladder decompression during a urohydropropulsion in a patient with a very compromised bladder. Had been obstructed for perhaps 36 or more hours. And in the event where the respondent felt that this bladder had ruptured, she had an ultrasound, she was doing the cystocentesis, and leakage of urine post-cystocentesis would not result in a rapid easily detected and collected accumulation of fluid. The only thing that would do that is the bladder rupture. And in addition to that, the patient acutely became, right after this cystocentesis of the bladder decompression, acutely painful and shocking right at the time. So I believe the respondent adequately explained her reasons for believing that the bladder had ruptured. They seem consistent with what I would expect. So, I differ from the investigative committee in that respect. I have a different concern about this case management. So my concern is that the lack of a proper deep sedation or anesthesia to attempt to relieve obstruction in the case with this presentation. The respondent states that she gave a light dose of hydromorphone. Well, she gave a dose of hydromorphone of 0.075 milligrams per kilogram. That's a pretty low dose. 0.05 is the low, and up to 2. However, she stated in her post-investigative committee letter that it was 0.01, unless I read it wrong or did the math wrong, that was a lower dose than that. And so the question is that sufficient to provide adequate sedation for an obstruction in a male dog that's going to now undergo catheterization or neural hydropropulsion to try to relieve this obstruction with a stone. It's my experience and my opinion that relieving an obstruction and performing this procedure in a case with this presentation requires heavy sedation or anesthesia. In the respondent's narrative, we have statements to the fact that the rupture happened due to bladder distension and his movement. So he was moving. He was not deeply sedated or anesthetized. And she states that he was relaxed until he suddenly moved. Well, he suddenly moved because he wasn't, in my opinion, in deep enough sedation or anesthesia. But we have this difference of opinion between me and the investigative committee. So I believe we need the respondent to be able to come in and talk to us and respond to both, demonstrate to us how she believes the bladder was ruptured and discuss the procedure with us. So in this case, I would make a motion to move to reform.
Second.
So I hear you on the interpretation of the investigative committee's findings. I agree with you on the rupturing of the bladder. I think the investigative committee didn't have necessarily her statement of post, which gave a little bit more information. And that may be why we have a difference there, because there was certainly a lot more detail in that. As for the sedation, I mean, I think she felt comfortable that the dog was sedated. And I think it's really hard in some of these cases because we're looking back at, oh, what could I have done differently? And hindsight is 20/20, but sometimes. And I think we have to step back and say, instead of looking at it that way, we have to look at it at the point in time that this happened. And if at the point in time that this happened, she felt that Rocky was fully sedated and as a board, then we feel like what we were seeing in the medical record in her statement that Rocky was fully sedated, then I don't feel like we should look at it backwards and say, yeah, but he did end up moving, because we can't really do that at the time that she would have been in this position. So I say that just as we look at whether we want to move it to an informal or not. I think this is a really rough case, and I feel for these owners because you have a 2-year-old dog that died of something that,
sure,
you know, it was a treatable condition. But there was a lot going on here too. So I I just say that I would rather use present time and judgment before we become formal, if we feel like that's enough. If not, let's
Yeah, these relieving an obstruction like this can be extremely difficult. She didn't mention anywhere doing the procedure where she would walk the urethra via rectal and try to balloon up the urethra. That, to me, is urohydropulsion. I didn't see that in there. It's difficult. You can't get that catheter in. You can't move that stone, we'll call it. And you have the concern where the bladder's already distended that you're going to potentially be flushing more fluid into that bladder. So her decision to do the decompressed cystocentesis was entirely reasonable and proper. Sometimes you relieve the pressure off that bladder and you can get a little more relaxation in the urethra. But I've done a lot of these and these difficult ones, and I'm trying to think back, using light sedation, maybe in the beginning, and yeah, I got it, the stone, but if I'm struggling with it to the point where I've got to do a decompressive cystocentesis, I don't want my patient moving at all, period. I don't want to take any chance of it moving. And hydromorphone is not, at this dose, is a very light pre-anesthetic, basically. So that was my concern. And so I just wanted the respondent to come in and explain those things to us and say in her experience and what she was doing and talk about this dose of hydromorphone. Because we do have the situation where, as you said, a young dog that was euthanized. And I think we need to hear more.
Yeah.
We need to talk to her.
I'm good with that. I think there were some questions still as to how much was offered to the owners
before they elected to do euthanasia as well.
Oh, I still
sure.
had some concern about that. So,
I
so if you are moving to an informal, then I can at least ask those questions.
Yeah, I do too. So.
All right, so we have a motion, we have a second. All those in favor of moving case 2510 to an informal?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? All right, motion carried.
I just had one statement. I just have to make this statement. This is the kind of where we are in veterinary medicine, and it's disturbing when these cases come up. We went from a young, healthy dog to obstructed to a bladder rupture to a call to a surgeon and an estimate of 9,800 to 12,000 to euthanasia. And those are so, that's where we're at, and that's so sad. That's the difference between an emergency clinic and a regular practice. Where this, in a regular practice, this is my client who I've maybe had for years. I say, what can we do? How about I go in there and take a look and see what's happened? And instead, we just went boom, 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 euthanasia because of cost.
Yeah.
And it's sad. And this happens over and over again with this urgent care emergency. And I don't have any answers to them. And I'm not saying they don't care about their clients. That's not the point.
Well, and I would say it's sad. It's what I do all day for a living. But what I would add to that is, as veterinarians, depending on level of experience and how many of these surgeries have they done, they can choose to say, I'm not doing that surgery. Right? It's in their rights, so we can't.
Yeah.
It's not like, I think back when I got out of school, it was way more common for some of these procedures to be done in a general practice.
Oh.
And academia has shifted so much that I think many students are getting out going, I can't do this. Better care would be received if they went to a specialist. And so they're doing the right thing in the interest of the pet, but better care, if you can't afford it, is not better care. And so we've kind of swung that pendulum too far. And as a profession, we will right-size it, but it doesn't help with those of us today, because I think we're finding
etc. So we'll get off our soapbox.
Yes, but I could talk all day. All right, so that concludes 2510. The next case we're going to move to is 2513. And Tracy, would you read the case summary for that one?
Yes. Case 2513, Nicole Bennett and Heather Hartwig. The respondent is Amanda Ponsava, DVM. On July 20th, 2024, Bruiser, a 15-year-old male, 12, was presented to respondent to evaluate a cough. Complainant reported the dog had heart disease and kidney disease. The dog was recently weaned off of Lasix due to elevated kidney values, and complainant advised that the dog did well while taking pimobendin and hydrocodone as prescribed. Complainant did not want to give the dog hydrocodone. Respondent offered trimethoprazine with prednisone for the dog's cough after advising complainant of the risks of the medication in patients with heart disease. Complainant stated that she had the medication at home. Due to complainant's financial constraints, respondent recommended she return home to confirm she had the correct medication and strength. Complainant called later that day advising she in fact had the appropriate medication. It was determined that the medication was likely expired, therefore complainant picked up a written prescription from respondent's premises. Complainant stated in her complaint that the medication respondent prescribed should not be provided to animals with heart disease, kidney disease, and seizures. Respondent stated that complainant did not disclose that the dog had seizures. And the committee concluded that no violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred. It was moved and seconded that the board dismiss this issue with no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Alright, so this case 2510, Dr. Chantilly, you're the lead. We have the respondent and counsel. I did not show the guest complaint. So we can take a response first. Alright, so I have no idea, he butchered your people's names. But Dr. Statements. So if you have anything you'd like to add at this point, you have 5 minutes up to address the board with any key call-outs or anything that's changed since you submitted.
There's nothing changed. She's here just to answer any questions that the board itself may have. Otherwise, we agree with the committee's position, or the investigative committee's position.
I actually don't have any questions. If you were quite thorough in your statements. Just discuss the case. In reviewing 2513 with Bruiser, Tenoral P was prescribed because the dog was having a cough that had previously been treated with a different medication at another veterinary clinic that the owner no longer wanted to give for whatever unknown reason. There were concerns by the complainant that this medication, Tenoral P, should not be given to pets that have cardiac disease and seizures or kidney disease. Some of this information was not related to the respondent that the pet had these conditions. And even in those conditions for that drug, it says that it should be used with caution, not that it cannot be used. And if we look at the dose in which was prescribed, it was on the very low end of that therapeutic range. So I would call that caution, even though we weren't aware of there being underlying issues. So I would agree with the investigative recommendations and see no violation, dismiss no violation.
Yeah, I think a lot of this one was what the owner heard from friends and potentially other people that have already, you know, according to the statements and what we have already been discussed. So I think that's kind of left for this.
Tracheal collapse is tough. And you try different things, and they cough so hard sometimes. hydrocodone is the only thing that's going to work.
Yeah.
But you try everything, and this is certainly the way it was used by this respondent.
Yes.
Totally appropriate.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So that is my motion.
For IC findings of no violations, can we have a second?
Second.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? No. All right. Motion carries, and that closes case 2510. The next case that we will move to is 2501. And Tracy, would you read the summary?
Yes, case 2501, the complainant is Jared Pollock. The respondent is John Carr, DVM. On May 15, 2021, Tucker, a 10-year-old male boxer, was presented to respondent due to lameness in dark school. After evaluation, respondent made a presumptive diagnosis of coxofemoral osteoarthritis and Librera was administered. Blood was collected for testing. Complainant was instructed to continue glucosamine and meloxicam and return in 1 month for a second Librera injection. On May 17, 2024, complainant reported to respondent's premises that the dog had right rear leg was barely functioning. He was advised through reception staff to give it the weekend. On May 20th, 2024, respondent emailed complainant with blood work results showing hypothyroidism. He was made aware that the dog had been to an emergency facility being treated for myelopathy. Later, complainant updated respondent via an email that the dog was at a neurologist for an MRI and they suspected FCE. After many veterinary evaluations and diagnostics, the dog was eventually diagnosed with a neoplastic splenic mass that had metastasized. On June 24, 2024, the dog was humanely euthanized. Complainant expressed concerns that Librela was inappropriate for the dog's condition, creating mobility issues resulting in the dog not being a surgical candidate to address underlying issues. And the committee concluded that no violations of the Veterinary Practice Act have occurred. It was moved and seconded. The board dismissed this issue with no violations. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Thank you. All right, so in the case of 2501, we do not have the respondent or the complainant, so we can move straight into discussion, and I am the lead on that case. So, I think in reviewing this case, there were a couple things that I was like, why did we do that? Or could we have done something differently? I think the biggest piece was when the Tucker's leg continued to get worse and the owners called the clinic and they were told to give it the weekend. And maybe at the point that it's gotten to the point where the dog's not using the leg, we say, that might need more immediate attention. But again, it's one of those where it's a judgment call in the moment, and I don't know exactly how that was said either. So I don't necessarily know that falls to the level of a violation on anybody. It just was something that kind of stood out to me as I was reviewing this case. So I didn't see anything in here that I was concerned would reach a violation, and I would support the investigative committee's findings. Any other comments? All right, so in the case of 2501, I'll make a motion that we find no violations of our practice act.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? No. All right, motion carries. That concludes case 2501.
Renee McDuffie, the respondent is Deborah Boston, DVM. On June 29, 2024, Digger, a 14-year-old male Yorkshire Terrier, was presented to an emergency facility due to increased respiratory rate, heart rate, and failed gas. The dog was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and complainant elected to manually euthanize the dog. Complainant stated the dog appeared happy and healthy even the night before the emergency visit. Complainant expressed concerns that respondent and her associate had already examined the dog and did not identify a partner. The committee concluded that no violation of the veterinary practice act had occurred. It was moved and seconded that the board dismiss this issue with no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Okay.
All right, so in 2504, we do not have the respondent, but is there still just monitoring or
monitoring
only? And then we do not have the complaint. And Dr. Thompson, I think you're the lead on this one.
Yeah, so we can jump right into discussion. This case is difficult for both the complainant and the respondent. This is a case where we have an elderly dog who was apparently normal and then acutely not, and having difficulties breathing. It was an emergency situation and turned out to have acutely acquired a significant heart murmur and congestive heart failure. And as an owner, it's very much a question of like, how this happened. My dog was just at the vet, and how did they not determine this? And unfortunately, these things can happen and do. And I've seen it myself in practice, and it is very scary. And essentially, one chordate tendine, a little leaf that helps with the valves, can just rupture and cause that valve to just be blown open, for lack of a better terminology, and allow the heart to go into heart failure. And that essentially, based on the description from both parties, both veterinarians, that is what happened in this case. There was nothing that the respondent could have preemptively done to identify that this was going to be an issue or going to happen. With this case, I would recommend to dismiss with no violation.
Yeah, there's a clue in the radiographs that this, there was cardiomegaly, but not severe cardiomegaly, which you see with a long-standing congestive heart failure. So it's quite possible that this dog did not have murmur all along up, and then an acute failure of that valve, probably coronary.
Yeah.
And if we saw a huge heart in there that had been getting bigger for months and months, you'd go, well, maybe they missed a murmur or what, but that fact stuck out to me that we did not have that much cardiomegaly.
Right, and I mean, how traumatic for the owner.
That
is absolutely just a horrific experience. And we wish as practitioners we could have a crystal ball to know that was going to happen and prepare them, but unfortunately we don't. So
I'll second the motion.
All right, so we have a motion to dismiss and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Great, motion carries. That concludes case 2504. And the next one on the list is case 2505. Tracy, would you read that summary for us?
Yes, let me get there. Okay. Case 2505. The complainant is Adamar Corian, and the respondent is Dana Wales, DVM. On July 10, 2024, Nadal Azar, a 7.5-year-old female cover of Welsh Corgi, was presented to respondent for a swollen face. The dog was examined. Two puncture wounds were noted on the top of the dog's head. However, respondent did not believe they were due to a snake bite. Blood work was performed. No changes in the cells to indicate snake bite were noted. An ultrasound was performed. No abscess was noted. The dog was administered dihydramine and dexamethasone, sodium phosphate, and was discharged with prednisone and amoxiclav. Respondent also recommended advanced imaging of the skull. On July 11, 2024, the dog was presented to the primary care veterinarian for evaluation due to continued swelling. A quick blood smear evaluated a large number of echinocytes, indicating that the snake bite had occurred. The dog was hospitalized for IV fluids, dexamethasone, macrocyclovine, and pain medication. The dog improved and was discharged later that evening. Complainant expressed concerns that respondent misdiagnosed her dog, and as a result, the dog could not receive anti-venom. When the committee concluded that no violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, it was moved and seconded that the board dismiss this issue with no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Mr. Spall, monitoring only?
Yes, ma'am.
And we do not have the respondent or the complaint. And you're the one, right?
Yeah. this one, I've been in this situation many times, having practiced for a long time in Tucson, and have seen 100 or more of these cases. The complaint centers around the respondent failure to diagnose a rattlesnake or snake bite by observing echinocytes on blood smear. The pet presented to the urgent care at 2:09 and was told, the complainant was told that it's not a snake bite. Pretty certain that it wasn't a snake bite. The record reflects this. And the complainant left the clinic thinking, well, it's not a snake bite. And it was ultimately treated as an allergic reaction and or an infection. The respondent performed a thorough workup on the case and did do blood work and a blood smear. And based on that blood smear, there was no echinocytes or platelet decrease. The presumption was this is not a snake bite. Also added to that, width of the puncture wounds. And I'm not sure how we can make a determination. There are some big rattlesnakes out there. And it doesn't always correlate with the amount of venom, but that's a different subject. But then we have 18 hours later, the pet presents to the Banfield Hospital and immediately was concerned about snake bite, did a slide, saw the echinocytes, made the diagnosis this was indeed a rattlesnake bite. So the respondent, based on no echinocytes or decreased platelets in the spacing of the punctures, stated pretty unequivocally in the record no signs of snake bite, and then proceeded as you would with a swelling, is this an allergic reaction, or possibly a dog bite, cellulitis, abscess type situation, and then treated for the allergic reaction. And there wasn't any response. Then considered infection and looked for an abscess and did not seem to be the case either. So there were so many things in this case that were suggestive of snake bite. First of all, the history. The dog had been outside all night with another dog, but had been outside all night. Came in the morning and head started swelling with these puncture wounds on top. The thing that stuck out to me when she was going through this case, working through this case, she notated significant swelling of the lips and neck. This dependent edema, that occurs very commonly with snake bites. That's what they do. Could it occur with something else? Yeah, severe cellulitis, long-standing maybe, something like that. But that dependent edema, where the bite is higher and then it travels down. That's what snake bites do. And they, in a picture from Banfield, you look at that picture and go, oh, that's a rascal. The failure to respond to treatment for an allergic reaction tells you that we're probably not dealing with insect or other reaction. She even did an ultrasound on the swelling to look for a pocket for an abscess. Didn't see that. We did have a very slight white cell elevation, but was concerned about infection at that point. We were going everywhere but snake bite. And in the record, on the discharge, you see Medalla, if I'm saying the dog's name right, is very depressed. All through this was how depressed this dog was. And it presented with a subnormal temperature. So we have a subnormal temperature. If we were dealing with infection, you would expect it to be high, and you'd expect the depression to be maybe related to a high temperature. We didn't have that. Very depressed dog, dependent edema, a swelling on top of the head with two punctures. So some of the points I took from that, echinocytes are not present in all cases of snake bite. And they can take time to show up. In this case, it took some time for them to show up. But soon after a snake bite, in the first few hours, the punctures can appear just as unremarkable punctures. And I looked at some of these cases and tried to look at these wounds and say, is this or isn't this a snake bite? It takes time for the necrosis and to develop around the wound. Wounds, so, and that wouldn't be present early, but then it was present 18 hours later. The concern here is that if untreated, a rattlesnake bite, meaning you don't give any antivenom or supportive care, that can lead to serious problems, both locally and systemically, up to and including death. So you would want to err on the side of it being a snake bite, if anything. You're not going to just take it off the list. And so I had this concern for almost definitively declaring this case is not a snake bite, and the differential then being allergic reaction or infection. Further evidence that the respondent was totally taking snake bite off the list. So she thought, well, it's not an abscess, it's not an allergic reaction. I don't think it's, all right, it's not a snake bite. Maybe we ought to do some advanced imaging on this one. So, having been in this situation a lot of times, I just have concern about this one. And so I am definitely leaning toward a violation and offering a consent agreement in this case. So I would love to hear thought process.
So thank you for the information, right? I think it's helpful for folks that aren't familiar with the process and what we look for. I guess my question would be, one, I personally snake bite, given where we live and what we see, that should be one of our top differentials. The treatment of snake bite, six and one half dozen the other, there's always a question as to whether or not you should use antivenom. And right. So then what was the treatment that was provided at Banfield? Dexamethasone, diphenhydramine, right. Which was the same treatment that was provided at the emergency hospital, mm-hmm. right? So there really wasn't, we did do some IV fluids as well, but there wasn't much difference. And even knowing that the dog had been outside for the evening, right, mm-hmm. overnight, if it was a snake bite, we don't know when that snake bite occurred. And so if you're past that couple, 4 hours or whatever, that like antivenom even then is questionable as to whether or not we should give it. It's yes. not necessarily a 24-hour thing. It's a much shorter period of time in which it's going to be most efficacious, right? So I don't know as if our treatment plan would have changed much if we would have kept snake bite as our primary differential. So I guess that's just a question to kind of throw out. We were at a point where it was, the treatment that we gave didn't necessarily give us the results that we were looking for, and then the owner sought additional treatment, which, as you should, right? On an emergency basis, you give a certain amount of treatment, and then if that isn't continuing to work, you either come back to the emergency hospital or go to your referring veterinarian. So I don't know. Are we going to just hang on the fact that it wasn't a primary differential when it probably was? The treatment was essentially still the same, and the outcome was still the same. So,
well, it's controversial. All the treatments, antihistamine, steroids, antivenin. When do you give it? How long afterwards? And the early giving of antivenin is certainly preferred, but I have found, and there's evidence to suggest, that you may get lucky and not have a major systemic envenomation, but that locally you could get some horrendous necrosis at the site of the wound, and antivenin does seem, even later on, to help with that. I've euthanized dogs because of what the wound did. A case comes to mind, a dog bit under the neck, and the whole bottom of the neck slowed off. So,
you could go back and forth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I obviously, in where I work, we don't have antivenin. Do we get snake bite animals? Absolutely.
Sure.
And do we have a lot of positive cases? Gotcha.
Yeah.
So, there's always going to be those special ones that are going to be more difficult, right? And again, it's hard when you have differing information, even from the experts, as to when to use the antivenin.
Sure.
If you don't have these clinical signs, then you shouldn't use it. If you don't have, if you're not in this window, you shouldn't use it. So that, that's
so
hard.
So, yeah. But we fall back is, I missed the diagnosis, but I got lucky and did the right treatment. So is that a concern for us?
Well, I don't know that we would necessarily know for sure. I mean, I'm surprised that the medical records have no evidence of snake bite.
In several places,
because I'm like, there is evidence that there's a potential snake bite with two punctures anywhere on the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
right.
Just two punctures alone make you go, there is evidence of a potential snake bite. Take everything else out of it. So the fact that it says no evidence of snake bite, I think what she meant by that is, even though there were some signs of the snake bite, she didn't think that that's what it was. But that's not what was said, and so there's a little bit of unclarity there. But I honestly think she didn't think that what this dog was dealing with was a snake bite, or I think she would have, I don't know that she would have done anything different, but I think the conversation would have been different with this owner. I don't necessarily know that I find it a violation, and here's why, because I think the treatment that was done is justifiable at that point that she was at, and had the dog come back to her, she could have had the opportunity to adjust treatment and do things differently based on the signs and how they were progressing and what was going on. She wasn't given that opportunity because the regular vet was now open and they could go there. So I guess I go, it would be different if this owner had returned to her and she had still said, it's not the same thing, I'm not doing anything differently. Then I would have been more concerned. But I definitely feel like, especially in urgent care, where you're dealing with these on a regular basis, I guess, that it was that definitive that it was not the same way. But I probably would be more to a letter of concern on that than a violation, just because I don't think it would have necessarily changed too much of how she would have handled it. And because I don't know on the antivenin if that would have been something I would have done because of not knowing even when this would have occurred. The dog was outside for 12 hours.
Yeah. I've given antivenin 48 hours later. And sometimes in the owner saying,
yeah, I don't think
there's antivenin, isn't there? And you say, well, it's been pretty long for this to work. I don't care. Give it.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with giving it. I just think that it's not a violation to not have given it.
But if you take it off the table with the potential consequences, the advent of treatment, if you take that off the table immediately, like you said, saying this is not a snake bite, if we'd have gone the route of some of these dogs,
right.
We would have lost this dog.
We'd be having a different discussion.
Yeah, we'd have a totally different discussion. But I understand. Why don't we just vote on the motion and see where it goes and then go from there?
So we have a motion.
Rather than withdrawing it.
We have a motion to find a violation
of 32, 22, 32, as it relates to R311501, failure to follow acceptable medical procedures for defendant who's ruling out SNCC fight with significant evidence to the contrary.
All right, so we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
All right, we have a second. Let's do
a
roll call on this one.
Dr. Byrne is nay. Dr. James?
Nay.
Dr. Nosley?
Aye.
Ms. Solomon?
Aye.
Dr. Thompson?
Nay. All right, so that, so 3-2, so that motion fails. I will make a motion in the case of 2505 that we dismiss the case with no violations, but issue a letter of concern for indicating that there were no signs of a snake bite when there were signs of a potential snake bite.
Second.
Motion and second. Want to do the roll call again?
Sure. Dr. Byrne, aye. Dr. James?
Aye.
Dr. Nosley?
Aye.
Ms. Solomon?
Aye.
Dr. Thompson?
Aye. All right, so motion passes, and that concludes case 2505. All right, so the next case we're going to do is 2512. And Tracy, could you read the summary for us?
Yes. Case 2512, the complainant is Hillary Dowson. The respondent is Michael Robinson, DVM. On July 23rd, 2024, Tank, a one-year-old male French bulldog, was presented to respondent for a neuter procedure. During the procedure, complainant asserts respondent's communication was unprofessional. Respondent denies there were any unprofessional discussion. While in recovery, the dog arrested. CPR was performed without success, and the dog passed away. The committee concluded that possible violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred. It was moved and seconded that the board find ARS 22-2232-11 gross negligence, failure to deal with the dog's respiratory distress based on the breed and circumstances, and for diminishing the pet owner concerns with respect to the respiratory distress. ARS 322-2232-12, as it relates to R311501, failure to show respect to an animal owner during conversations that occurred in the surgical suite, and failure to provide professionally acceptable procedures for administering an overdose of epinephrine to the dog. ARS 322-2232-21, as it relates to R311502, C, H1, H2, H3, and H4, and those are medical record keeping violations. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Okay, so 2512, we have Dr. Robinson present, and we do not have a complaint. And I just told you what they really do with Dr. Robinson first.
Oh. Right, you just 5 minutes to.
Yeah. You want to come forward to the chair? For the purpose of the record, would you please state your name?
Dr. Michael Robinson.
Great. So we've read everything that's been submitted, but if there has been anything that has come up since your submission or anything you just want to especially highlight, you have 5 minutes to kind of give us that information, and then we'll open up.
Okay. First of all, we allowed her in the room, and I quit doing that after all this. Then while we were in the room getting ready for the surgery, we were just talking. She's a very nice client, very, yeah. But nothing inappropriate was ever said, ever. That's been stretched. The concern about gross negligence, that dog was never left alone, was monitored all the time. I was there within seconds when we were informed that there might be a problem. I was just across the hall, like 12 feet away. And as soon as we noticed that the dog was having trouble, Mary started oxygen on her right away. The owner came and got me. I walked across the hall within seconds, and we inserted a trach tube. He did not respond to treatment, but there was no neglect. And record-wise, since all this, I'm about to retire, so I got kind of lazy with records. And so I've re-stimulated myself, and we're doing better records now and permission to treat forms. And we've kind of, I got behind on that. Over the years, I just got lax about it. But anyway, so that's changed. Do you have any questions for me?
Well, we will, if that's all you have to add, we will go ahead and start the discussion on the case.
I could keep going on it, but I'll waste your time. If Mary could talk, she was there.
You want to hear from Mary? Do you have a lead on this one?
Yes, I think we'll lead on that.
Yes, I have a lead on this one. Can I just ask a couple of questions, Mary? Were you present in the surgical suite at the time of the neuter?
No, I was not.
Okay. And you were monitoring the pet post-surgery?
Yes.
And you were the responsible party for removing the trach tube?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And you were with the pet from the moment it came off the surgical table until the trach tube was removed?
Yes, ma'am.
And
I'll see if it's going to prevent us
from going
to an informal get the same.
Yes. So,
but I do know we didn't have you state your name, so would you please?
My name is Mary Margaret Smith. I'm a certified vet assistant.
Thank you. And so, could you briefly describe what happened when the patient, after you extubated? What was the duration of time between after you extubated and when we went into respiratory distress?
Maybe a two to three minute period. The owner of the dog was in there. I had turned around to take some 4x4 gauze and put it in the closet. She had picked the dog up and laid it onto a dog bed. We do surgeries with a dog on a dog bed. When I took the tube out, his eyes were bright. He was actively chewing on the tube. I released the bulb, slowly pulled the tube out. I turned around, the owner had picked the dog up off the operating table and had laid it onto the dog bed. And I turned around and looked at him, and he was breathing a little odd. So I grabbed the mask, hooked it up to the oxygen tank, turned the oxygen on, and started giving him oxygen. Within seconds, I was getting ready to yell for Dr. Robinson because I noticed his breathing was even, more heavy. She ran out, got Dr. Robinson, he came right into the room.
Okay. And that room is 12 feet away?
It's even,
it's across the hall.
Yes, it's even 12 foot. But what I did notice is when she laid him down, normally when French Bulldogs, dogs that have the short muzzles, I can't think of the name of it right now, we always lay the head and keep the head straight, that way the neck is straight, that way there's an open breathing. I noticed in that second, when I was grabbing for the mask, that his head had placed down. And when I put the mask, I opened, pulled his chin up, put the mask on him and kept his, and that's when Dr. Robinson came in and we got him off to the operating table and inserted another trach tube and went on from there.
Thank you. I don't have any further questions.
Great. You can stay there or you can step back, whichever you feel more comfortable with, and we'll start discussion.
Yeah, so this case is, obviously we had a sad outcome, and some of the accusations or information about this case are very difficult because they are accusations, and it's a he said, she said, which really makes things difficult, and we know that the truth lies somewhere in the middle, usually. And we also know that things can get inflamed when a traumatic situation is happening as well. So, there are concerns about that. As we go through the process, and looking at the recommendations of the IC, it is difficult for the gross negligence in my mind, in that the dog did go into respiratory distress. We did actually try to resuscitate the pet. I guess where, if anywhere that we could look at gross negligence is the dosing of the epinephrine, because that was 20 times the required amount for resuscitating that pet. So I wouldn't necessarily have it as failure to deal with the dog's respiratory distress. I'd probably pinpoint it more towards the dosing of the epinephrine. When I look at the next violation, 3222, 3212, as it relates to 311, 5011, failure to show respect, I think that is a very difficult one for us to actually prove. we were not present in that area, and you know, according to other staff, the staff for the pre-vet student that was there did not hear those same things. So, you know, we have a two